So today on the podcast, I'll be speaking with physician and medical entrepreneur, Dr. Kirk Kennard. Dr. Kennard has been a physician in Mississippi for close to two decades, specializing in pain management since 2008. He's also a Mississippi native and was born there, grew up there, and completed his medical training there. His practice focuses on pain relief, improved physical function, and enhanced quality of life while minimizing the role of medications, which can result, as we know, in chemical dependency and addiction. He is dual board certified in anesthesia and pain medicine and has dedicated his career to helping people manage and recover from chronic pain. So with medical marijuana recently being legalized in Mississippi, we'll have a lot to talk about, including debunking some common misconceptions, as well as Dr. Kennard's launch of statewide clinics to help residents of the state obtain a medical marijuana card.
Welcome to the Entrepreneur Podcast, filled with marketing and leadership tips on launching and growing your business with your host, Deanne Mora.
Dr. Kennard, welcome.
All right. Thank you for having me, Diane. And that was a very poignant and accurate assessment of things up to this point. So I'm excited to be with you to bring some more clarity and like you said, kind of demystify this whole process, because I think when people hear the word marijuana, there's lots of connotations of that. And I want it to be, you know, understood and perceived in the best light. Obviously, we're calling it medical. So we are now subcategorizing a word and a substance and a social chemical, if you will, into a realm of the highest level of respect. And so it's hard for some people to make that jump, and I want to help them make that jump.
It is, absolutely. Well, let's lay the foundation and start at the beginning. So you were born and raised in Mississippi. What was it like for you growing up?
Yeah, so I had a great upbringing on the Mississippi Gulf Coast, a small town, blue collar town. I have an older brother and a younger sister, and I would say that we had a lot of opportunities, but we're also pushed very much to find opportunities and do something about them. And so, from an early age, though, I may not have known that much about medicine, but I gravitated towards it. And so often in summers during high school, I would ask my family's physician friends if I could tag along in the summer and come to their clinic and watch them operate, not necessarily in an operating room, but just how they go about their daily routine. And then naturally, those same physicians would feel comfortable and kind of sensed that I was pretty serious about it. And so they would start asking some questions that would matter to help guide me. And so, I've kind of known at least the last couple of years of high school that my life's goal was to go to medical school and be a physician. So, and you really need to start pretty early. Just the track itself is a long one and arduous one. And so you got to kind of get started. It's not usually something that you go to college for 3 years and then decide. That's tough. And then you have to have the availability to pay for 3 years of college that may not have mattered. And usually that's the breaking point.
Yeah, I think it's the longest college, education process that there is.
Once per child, right? So
right. So how young would you have been when you started spending time with other physicians in their clinics?
I mean, probably just mid-teens. Yeah, so... And so in college, when I was pre-med, I really knew that if I was going to do this and do it right, and you've got to find a competitive edge. So if you're not number one in your class, you better have another edge. And I felt like the edge I could bring is being able to communicate with people, especially in the South and in Mississippi, and come back here and practice and, mix in good knowledge base and be a good technical physician if that's what it required, but also have the bedside manner so many people seek.
So I mean, important.
A lot of times your visit doesn't hinge on whether your treatment is perfect. It's a lot more than that to most people. They can be told an answer they didn't want to hear in a respectful way that they can understand and still be appreciative when they leave. And so in pain management, where I ultimately ended up through all that training and all those residency years, and then I did a fellowship in pain management to end it, it's especially valuable when you're in a face-to-face meeting on a daily basis with people that are kind of at the end of their rope. As opposed to just a well visit with your primary care doctor. Everything's kind of great on those and everything's fine, draw a little blood work. I'm not saying I'm not undermining primary care by saying that. It's a different bear when each patient that you're going to walk into the room and speak to, they're in chronic pain. And I've seen that through my career, what that can actually do to one's psyche and affect them on many more levels than just the physical burden.
Absolutely. Yeah. It just wears on you. And a lot of times chronic pain is something that it's not visible to other people. So if you suffer from, chronic back pain, for example, physically you might look fine,
right,
and you're in agony, and it's difficult for other people to understand that. And, sometimes I think people question, well, is it all in your head?
Right.
So dealing with that as a physician has to be challenging.
Yeah. Very interesting concept that you brought up that you may not recognize it about pain behaviors. So sometimes people have to project a certain way to get someone to listen to them. And so they want to be that stoic person that doesn't wear their heart on their sleeve and burden other people. But it gets to a point where they realize, if I do not, I'm not going to be heard. And then I may not get treatment, and their desperation starts to take over. And so they start exhibiting those behaviors that would get people's attention when they really would prefer not to. So it's a very dynamic thing. So is it in your head? Well, it wasn't. You were trying to handle it and mitigate it the best you could, but then you started exhibiting behaviors, but then there's, you didn't have an injury or a car wreck or three surgeries to explain it. My headache really is that bad. I can't see your headache. There's no lab to draw for it. That ability to empathize first and then go to the next step is very important. And so when you take all of chronic pain management and everything that you have to, the history that you have to take, it needs to really start with emotional well-being. Because a lot of times, if you can't get that secured, the physical pain may not be the driver anymore. And so figuring out, is physical pain the driver, or is it converted over to just emotional distress and disability behaviors and social withdrawal, anxiety, insomnia? These are all very destructive consequences of untreated chronic pain. And that really is a good segue into, where does medical marijuana fit? And I'll give you that answer.
That was my next question. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, this is, so tell the audience about what has happened recently in the state of Mississippi, and how has this been an evolution? How has the law, the regulations begun to evolve to recognize, like you said, something that had a social stigma? It's quite a shift.
Yeah,
for us in terms of our sociology. So share a little bit of your perspective on that.
Very much so. It's sometimes physicians aren't the greatest with very open-ended questions like that. But I'm going to do my best to kind of make a broad picture of
this. I have faith in you.
Yeah, well, one of the things I told you I wanted to do is demystify this. And so how does somebody with my credentials and track record, and how do I get to the point where I am excited about the potential of medical marijuana? How do you make that leap? I feel like those behaviors that I talked about, they aren't always addressed by treating the pain. Sometimes they become chronic with the pain. And pain medication or a spinal nerve block or any of these other fancy techniques that I learn and that I employ every day may just not be enough to make the person well. Mm-hmm. So truly well. I feel like medical marijuana's role, and then I'll go back to how we got here in Mississippi. Medical marijuana's role is just as important in those behavioral aspects, the consequences of having lived with chronic pain, as it is purely an analgesic that will treat physical pain. Okay? That's something that I've really got to hit the road in, you know, a podcast or 100 or getting in the face of not just my physician colleagues, but a church congregation needs to hear that. If they heard it that way, it's hard to deny if you explain it in a way, in a medical sense, that medical marijuana won't represent itself well. It can really go bad. And there's some states that did not unroll this very well. They just are. But we're the 37th state to pass legislation. So this is not, it's new for Mississippi, but it's certainly not new. And in the history of using cannabis, any other herb or any other substance for medical treatment that's not FDA approved substance, we have a long track record with marijuana. And so there's a question I like to ask people to really put that this in perspective. No matter what side of the fence you fall on, it's here. And so we need to choose, are you going to be a part of making it the best it can be? Would you rather just be a neutral bystander and see what happens? Or are you staunchly against the whole idea and you cannot believe 70% of Mississippi voters said yes to some form of medical marijuana?
Big number.
That's a lot. If you take 70% of the people that actually went to the polls and voted, that's a different population than 70% of the entire population. If you can imply anything from what I'm saying, there's a lot of people that probably didn't go to the polls that have a strong view for medical marijuana. And so, because people that would accept that kind of already know its history that I'm implying now, and that it can be good for some people, right? And so, we don't have a lot of strong scientific, you know, clinical data to support it because it has been a federally illegal substance. On the DEA schedule, there are different schedules. It's a Schedule 1, which means it can't be prescribed for a medical treatment. It hasn't been FDA approved, and that there is some evidence that it is dangerous enough to be addictive or destructive. So therefore, it has no business in a clinical trial. Certainly one involving humans, right? Because you wouldn't want to give that substance. Well, we've softened on that, and they may declassify it from that schedule, so it can be studied. So you have a lot of people say, well, we don't have any data on medical marijuana. Well, we haven't been able to study it like other drugs.
Interesting.
But we do have some data, right? If you just say that since the 60s, that we've had exposure to marijuana. And tell me when you heard about the marijuana epidemic. Have you heard of it?
Well, I mean, marijuana has always been, the connotation has been something that, you know, people smoke at festivals, and it's been associated with sort of this dark side and not with any benefit. So this really is a mental shift to where we are today.
But even in the dark side, there's never been a marijuana epidemic that destroyed, you know, just left waste in its path, right? It's been around. There's not been an epidemic. So why is that? Why is there an opioid epidemic, cocaine, methamphetamine? Those are epidemics. The reason is it doesn't do physiologically what those other drugs can do to people in a destructive manner. So it's not all good. There is some abuse potential, obviously. If you take a whole bottle of aspirin, you're going to probably bleed out of your eyeballs, right? If you eat too many carrots, your skin is going to turn orange. You can overdo and overindulge in anything, many legal things and many over-the-counter medicines. You take too many ibuprofen a day and you don't tell your doctor about it, you may have some kidney dysfunction from that or an ulcer in your stomach. It's not the marijuana's fault that you could abuse it. I mean, if you said that about any substance or any medicine that we prescribe, and certainly opioids, which are legal, you can really go off the rails with anything. But even given the chance, marijuana's not done it. And so my stance is let's tease out those real benefits. And if you have too much marijuana in your system to operate a vehicle, you should be held accountable because you're putting other people at risk. If you're taking 5 milligrams in some non-smokable form, you're a nursing home resident and you get agitated in the evenings, you have some dementia and you get agitated in the evenings, it's called sundowning. And a 5 milligram, you know, a gummy helps settle you down and get to sleep. Is that not a win? Because we also know that the side effect profile is as favorable as it is, and maybe more so than a lot of other drugs that are used for that purpose. And so we just need to find the benefits and the place for it and then really promote that.
So it sounds like we're not, you know, the intent is not to prescribe medical marijuana in a way that gets us all high necessarily.
Right. Perfect.
But there's ways to use it that can alleviate some symptoms. So, you know, talk to me about that. What are we using medical marijuana for?
Yeah, great. So back to the church congregation statement. If I were to get up in front of my own church congregation and say, listen, this is not about taking something to put your mind in a state or get you high so that you forget about your illness or cover it up and you're just completely out of your mind. So that is not what we're talking about when we're talking about medical marijuana. It's so much more complex than that. The other chemicals in the plant than THC, they have medical benefit too. And so that's where the studies are really bearing more fruit. And they're showing that chemicals like the terpenes, which I can kind of go into a little bit more if you'd like, but you know, there's several different chemicals outside of the THC that makes people want to use it recreationally that have therapeutic benefit. Many people just don't know that.
The THC that gets you feeling high, yeah, correct?
THC is going to be the euphoria. It's also going to be responsible for some of the over-sedation. You know, if you're on sedative medications and you take too much of this, you can get off to where that's not safe for you and you may be at a fall risk, or it's operating machinery or a vehicle's probably not advised. And so, but it's a sedative thing that you can kind of backtrack and then control by just lowering your dose. It's not an all or nothing. It's usually a dose dependent thing, and you can kind of get a handle on where you settle. And it doesn't have to be so much that you are high. That is, it does not have to happen. And so I think a lot of people are under the impression that it's since it's been used recreationally to get high, because you certainly don't, you go to a concert and take it because it helps your back pain so you can stand and watch the concert longer, right?
Oh, maybe you do.
No, maybe. And maybe you will now.
Maybe now you do.
You'll have that opportunity. But recreationally, it's a different ball game. And so the amount that you take in your history of taking those substances is completely different than someone that is naive to it and is after it just in a palliative care sense or a desperate sense that not enough has worked for their condition. So I, in my practice of pain management, I'm glad just to have another tool. I do not think it will be a panacea, because at the same time, I can't talk out both sides of my mouth. It has been around. And if it was so good, it would have become medical so much sooner. And, you know, it wouldn't be 2022, Mississippi just passed it, right? If it was clearly and convincingly so good. But if it was so bad, they would have never, the legislators would never get behind something that was so bad that they could never get elected on anything else again because they supported it, right? So right. That middle ground has to be found. It's there. But it's not about getting high. It really is more complex than that in its use and in its capacity.
So it sounds like that's one of the myths that we're debunking about marijuana is that it's only a substance that we use to get high. So it sounds like we're saying medically that's not the case. Break down for me, give us a little bit, because I know this is new to a lot of listeners. We have medical marijuana, we have hemp, we have CBD. What's the difference and why do we need to legalize marijuana if it's not all about the THC?
Right. Great, great question. So if it's not get high and forget about your disease state, what is it? I mean, that's another way to say what you just did. So the hemp plant only produces THC in a flowering stage. Hemp used in textiles and rope and even construction materials in a lot of places for a long time is just the organic tissue of the leaf. Okay. So it has a role in manufacturing actually outside of its any chemical use. But also in the flower and the other parts of it that you can secure the chemical mixture outside of THC, which most people are familiar with that. They understand those three letters and THC gets you high. And higher the THC, the higher you're going to get. Like I think the majority of the population can relate to that. But what else? I mentioned terpenes. CBD is another substance that can be drawn from the plant, the hemp plant, that has therapeutic benefit. CBD oils and tinctures and products infused with it, it's a billions of dollar market. A fad doesn't create a billion dollars of market and then be sustained at least, right? There's got to be something to it besides a placebo effect, we call it in medicine, where you, because it was for your condition, it worked for your condition, and it didn't matter what was in that. You know, it's more of a psychosomatic effect. A $1 billion industry is not born on the placebo effect. So there's actually benefits to the CBD content, which is separate from THC, what's called the terpene content. And so we have receptors in humans have endocannabinoid receptors. So cannabis receptors, just keep it easy. They actually have receptors that in our tissue, brain, and even some of the peripheral tissues, that outside of THC, there's things in that marijuana plant that attach to and have effect change in. So the potential for it to be to help you get to sleep or decrease your anxiety is not all about what the THC is doing. And so there's a term called the entourage effect that takes the four or five chemical components that we know have physiologic effects in humans. And they all, I believe, work together in a medical marijuana product to help these disease states outside of, you know, THC is just one of them. So I think I've learned this since the law was passed. So this hasn't been a longstanding passion of mine to get, you know, to push medical marijuana through. I didn't really know as much what to think about it as anybody else. But it's here. And once I realized it's law and in pain management, I'm going to have to embrace it because my patients are going to want to explore that option. Because even as good as my training is and as hard as I try, I've really hit a wall with many patients in many conditions where we've literally tried everything we can. Mm-hmm. And this is not a Me Too alternative. This is completely different. If I don't offer it to them, they will likely go explore that on their own. And I could lose them as a patient if I just turn my back.
Well, and it sounds like that it can be so that the importance because of you talked about the different elements of the plant. And I'm assuming when you actually consume the product that you need a doctor to basically tell you, you know, how much to dose, right, you know, what right. you should be consuming. So what is the role of the physician when it comes to kind of overseeing the patient's use of medical marijuana?
Right. And that is the trick, because like me, most physicians, if they're looking at a THC concentration, it's in a urine or blood toxicology screen, right? And it's always a negative connotation. Oh gosh, it's a federally illegal substance. You know, you can't do that. You know, we all know it's not terribly harmful. You know, I'm not going to, you know, call in the Oxford Police Department and drag you off, but we've never been challenged to find how good it actually can be in a positive way. And we're going to all have to do that. That's why I say, if you're inclined at all, you need to make yourself aware of its good potentials. You also need to make yourself aware of the harm. There's a number that's floated about 10% of chronic marijuana users, not medical. I think it's all comers, 10% of chronic users. So that right there tells you that the limitation on the amount that you can get in Mississippi to take it medically is vastly different than the almost unlimited amount you can go by yourself if you'd like. And so to say all comers, 1 out of 10 develops what's called cannabis use disorder.
And is that addiction in other income?
It could be just dependence, which you have to be careful about trying to make those the same term. They're really not. So being dependent on a substance is not addiction always. Most addicts have a level of dependence, but it's not always the reverse is true. So dependency is if you took your blood pressure medication for a year and then abruptly stopped it or ran out of it, and you had a spike in your blood pressure, which could be dangerous. You're actually dependent on that blood pressure medicine. Because if you didn't have it, X could happen to you. Addiction is that the substance, unlike your blood pressure medicine, at least I've never heard of that, some of them being addicted to their blood pressure medicine, a substance that puts you in a psychoactive state that you're addicted to that state is a behavioral diagnosis. It's actually a clinical problem. It's neurobehavioral. It's the way your cells in your brain are reacting to the substance and telling you to do things that are harmful to you, and you know it. So despite your knowledge that it's harmful, you continue to do it. You can't stop it. So that's the difference in dependence and addiction. So being dependent on marijuana doesn't necessarily mean your life is spiraled out of control and you're self-destructing. It can simply mean that without it, you don't feel like you're the best you can be, and you could actually, you know, have some irritability and increased pain and things like that and sleeplessness that make you kind of dependent on it. See the difference? Yeah. It's really important to understand the difference in those terms.
Yes. So
medical marijuana and marijuana in general has never shown a predilection for a lot of full-blown addiction.
Okay. Right. So that's another myth that I think we'll have out there.
Yes.
Okay. And is there any ongoing effect? So in other words, if you, let's say you're somebody who suffers from chronic pain and you begin to, you know, your doctor prescribes medical marijuana for you and oversees the dosage and your pain feels better, is it a case where when you stop it, the pain comes back, or does it have any sort of ongoing healing effect?
Yeah. So as far as anyone is aware, it needs to be dosed, you know, routinely to continue to have the effect. And I never really answered your question, which was a very good one about, I think there's a lot of education that's going to have to occur and fluid learning by these practitioners about what dose, what form, because, you know, physicians, by their training, they get no training in this. You're required to get some CMEs to be a prescriber. Many of them are geared towards the side effects to make sure you know how to provide an informed consent to the patient and alert them of the potential benefits and risks, which is important. But they're not going to really know how to prescribe it like they typically would a drug and be held accountable like that. Mm-hmm. And they don't even have to. They're really, as a provider in this state, you're really just certifying that their disease is one that's acceptable for medical marijuana. You really aren't obligated to be more involved than just that. I started the dedicated clinics because I feel like that is not going to be probably good enough for getting this right.
Well, and talk to me about those. So tell me, what are the clinics that you started, and what is your goal? What is your vision for these clinics?
Yeah, so as I talk to my pain colleagues throughout the state that have similar practices to mine and a similar ideology and practice approach, those are the ones I gravitated to over my 15-year career that we talk about difficult cases together, and we see each other at events and expos and where we learn, and we share common challenges. As I reached out to them and said, how are you going to handle medical marijuana in your practice? Nobody had a really good answer. It was like, I don't know. I know that I probably need to figure it out, but I don't know where it will fit. Will we be able to prescribe opioids and medical marijuana at the same time? You know, what will the regulatory agencies think of that? Lots of questions, not a lot of answers. And so as I talked to them more, I started to think, it sounds to me like this deserves more than just a casual consideration in your busy day as a physician, wherever you are. I think to do it right, we're going to have a knowledge base and then a follow-up availability for patients, because they're also going to have the questions. I'm inexperienced with it. The general population, the greater part of it is going to be.
But at least you have the medical training to connect the dots with the additional data that we're going to see now that, you know, this is something that's more available and we can actually monitor people's response.
Right. So on that point, where are our data points? How will we know? Even if I educate myself, at least I've done that. But am I going to dedicate the time to have that consultation? And if I certify them and say, here's your card, I think it's a good option for you. You definitely meet the criteria, register with the Department of Health. And are you going to just say good luck? Or, you know, I think that's not good enough for us to get this right. By the law, that is the minimum requirement, that you certified their disease process and gave them an opportunity for it. Some patients will be okay with that and they'll do it on their own, and or they already are experienced and they know exactly what they need. And okay, but I think the majority of them are going to need more. And so I saw that being a very big challenge to incorporate into a very busy pain practice where we have 9 other tools that we're considering for someone's chronic pain. The ones that we've already been down that continuum and that we think are eligible for medical marijuana will be a little easier, but there are some that won't wait patiently to get all the way there and want to kind of do it at a different stage. And if I'm inclined to give you all the other things I did in my training, I may not get there as fast as you for medical marijuana. And that might be a difficult point between the provider and the patient. So I thought if we give pain clinics an option of a dedicated place to go discuss that treatment, but they continue everything else they're doing at the pain clinic, and the reverse, if someone comes to Paul's Pain and Wellness for a medical cannabis card, they may realize if board certified pain physicians are over the protocols and collaborating with physician assistants and nurse practitioners, if everybody is aware of all those other treatments they could have, we can then get them a card or say, you need so much more. You may want to consider that first. And here's a great group.
Almost a specialty, that can do that. It sounds like.
Yeah,
really,
it's an extension of the chronic pain specialty who is charged with helping clean up the opioid prescribing, which they did, but unfortunately it left a hole for the black market. If you have X number of people that are dependent or addicted to opioids, and even responsibly cut by a third the availability of that to them through medical prescribing, you now leave an avenue for the black market to satisfy that. And that's exactly what has happened with opioids. Unfortunately, as the prescribing has gone down every year since 2017, the death rate has climbed. And there's only one explanation for that. More dangerous non-pharmaceutical grade drugs have been infused. And, you know, I always use this example. Tom Petty, who I love and adore as a musical artist, he had a heroin problem. And he didn't really hide it. But when heroin wasn't available, medical grade heroin is opioids. And so he intermixed them. Well, when that became less and less available, he had to go outside his probably professional sources, or at least his source did. And then fentanyl was a part of it. And even an experienced heroin user has no chance against this fentanyl and this carfentanyl that is lacing some of these other drugs. So,
well, which goes back to the importance of, you know, medical marijuana, it sounds like it has a long, long history.
Right.
There's some myths that I think we've debunked today in terms of, you know, if it's overseen by a physician who, granted, this is new to everyone, but at least has the medical training to know what to look for and to kind of proceed with caution, it sounds like, when prescribing dosages, that this does not have to become, you know, an addictive substance. It doesn't have to get you high. It sounds like it can resolve or at least help with not only chronic pain, but some of the emotional issues, if you will, that that accompany chronic pain and many other diseases that, you know, we think about. I know there's a number of diseases that medical marijuana has been approved for in the state of Mississippi. But having that physician oversight by a physician who's truly taking the time to really understand the implications and understand you as a patient, and this is not a place where you want to DIY, it sounds like.
Right. You don't want to casually dip your toe into this. I think it's going to take more. And so I use also this kind of caveat when I explain that. Any medical provider with a DEA license, if they're going to prescribe a controlled substance, how often would they prescribe it and then have a patient follow up 6 months later for the first time? It would be very rare. And so why should medical marijuana get that treatment? By the law, you only have to follow up in 6 months. And I just don't think that's enough. And so if you get a busy practice that's interested in certifying patients for it, they may do everything right, but they're not available to answer those questions because they're too busy. And if they don't follow up until 6 months, it could have gone one of several different ways in that 6 month period. And they're not going to know. And so I think it deserves a little bit more attention, like it would any other drug that was started.
Sounds like it. So yeah, your clinics, Pause Pain and Wellness, as I understand it, they are presently being rolled out across the entire state of Mississippi. And it sounds like you're there not only to help the direct patients who may be interested in discussing the potential of medical marijuana, but also to help physicians who just simply have busy practices and don't have the time to specialize. So you could actually collaborate with other physicians, it sounds like, to add this as a tool to their practice.
Yeah. So in the 26 or so designated conditions that are acceptable by the law, out of a good 20 of those, they cross over into the chronic pain space. Mm. So, for instance, the Crohn's disease is an eligible diagnosis. Well, there is no evidence that any component of medical marijuana, including THC, affects change on the biological disease of Crohn's. It's to treat chronic abdominal pain, nausea, maybe wasting. Okay. So chronic pain infuses itself in almost all of the diagnoses. So really the chronic pain clinicians are going to see a lot more of that. And I think it's just going to apply more. The other major specialties are ultimately going to be psychiatry, neurology, and gastroenterology. I mean, out of those four, throwing chronic pain in there, you're covering really like 98% of every diagnosis in those four specialties. So why is a chronic pain specialty? That's why it's relevant, because it's going to be so many patients that seek it for pain.
So many diseases that cause pain, then that's the symptom that we really want to, that's the life disrupting symptom that we really want to deal with.
And that's the one that so all my collaborating physicians and teams are led by people that have the background and credentials that I do. And mm-hmm. so every day we're selecting treatments for these patients. And I think medical marijuana will be helpful for some, not helpful for some, and yet to be determined for some, just like every other treatment that we have. I really want to emphasize the point that I don't think it's going to be just a windfall. Like I said, we're the 37th state. If it was that great, you would be able to get it at the pharmacy without a prescription, right? If it's that safe and that great, the patient has to be selected appropriately, and then you have to follow up with them and make sure it's delivered safe and answer their questions. And then it's going to fall out where it does, but at least that's a respectable way to have it done. Oklahoma, unfortunately, allowed the product to be ascertained and grown and a lot of seeds and saplings and whatever you call them came in from a lot of different places, that they lost control of the quality management of the product. I hope Mississippi stays on track to really contain that, because if you're going to call it medical, if I'm going to prescribe something that has medical in front of it, I need to know that it's about as medical grade as you would expect too, right? So it's not FDA approved, not that strict, but if I'm going to prescribe it safely and put my reputation behind it, I need the product to be reliable. So on the growing end and the cultivating and however you turn it into what, whoever's doing that they need to be held to a very high standard, right? Mm. That's very important too. Because the only way it can be medical throughout is from beginning to end.
That makes 100% sense. Yeah. Well, Dr. Kennard, this has been really educational for me, and I'm sure for our listeners. And I know that if anyone is interested in learning more about Pause the Pain or Pause Pain and Wellness, they can go to pausethepain.com. Just to sum up, what's next for you and for Pause Pain and Wellness?
Yeah, so it's an exciting time. I mean, literally, this is our first week to enroll patients. So we're doing that. We have a very robust electronic health record that's going to help us be more efficient in our collection of patients' history and files and documentation that they need to get to us to make that determination, because, you know, someone's word is important and how it affects them is very relevant, but you need to match that with a diagnosis. In Mississippi is a state where people are accustomed to that live in rural areas to coming to a the city for care because it's a rural state. And so that's not a big deal to them. You do not need one of these on every block like you might in a very highly populated Atlanta, you know, Chicago. Eight clinics can probably cover almost 70% of the geographic state where someone wouldn't have to drive more than an hour. So that there was a strategic placement of those seven or eight so that we could cover it. And so if you're a physician that's just not bought in, you just, I don't know, I'm going to see how this goes. I kind of believe in it. My patients are asking me, I don't have a problem with them trying it. Will be an outlet for you, you know. And then maybe you want to only send the ones that you're unsure of because we're going to probably comb through it a little bit finer. It's just, I think, and we hadn't even talked about maybe the next time.
I feel like there's so many other questions that I have, and I know that we've run out of time for you.
The more I talk about to people, the more I learn and the more questions I actually have too. But there is a big, big role for this in extended care facilities, nursing homes, hospices, because it's a palliative step. It's palliating something, pain, anxiety, sleeplessness, agitation, spasticity. It's rectifying that within 30 minutes to an hour as a treatment with no known major side effects. And now it's medically available. So that's what it is. And however it can be employed, and like I told you, it won't have the potential to be, you know, a panacea. But I think if you select people carefully and you roll it out in a respectful manner, you have the best chance to make it a positive thing for all of Mississippi. Whereas if you're too loose, it can really go wrong. And that's not something I'd want to stand behind. So part of this is allowing the pain community and the good physicians that I know throughout the state to be a part of making it successful and meaningful and respectful.
This is such an exciting development for the people of the state of Mississippi. And I think that they can all feel more comfortable and assured knowing that there's a doctor like you helping make sure that all of the proper steps are taken in order to keep this treatment safe. Once again, if anyone listening would like to learn more, I believe you can be contacted at pausethepain.com. And once again, Dr. Kennard, I thank you so much for being on the podcast. I've learned so much today, and I feel like we can have many more conversations like this. So maybe I'll have to have you back again in the future.
Sure. I'd love to. And I appreciate your consideration, Diane. I hope to get better each one. You said, oh, you've done this so many times. The truth is I have not. So I've been treating patients and my head has been down, and I have two little girls at home that don't really care what I just finished doing all day. I'm daddy. They don't call me doctor. So
that's okay.
We all try to reach that balance. And so I basically just want to educate people to try to see what I see the potential of it being. It may fall short for me, but that's not an excuse not to try to affect it in a positive way, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so. Absolutely. Well, wonderful. Well, listen, again, thank you so much.
Okay, thank you very much, Diane.